watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KOWA Olympia, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Conventional wisdom is that there are no political prisoners in the United States. But that's incorrect. There are, and there always have been. Every development that was decent and good in this country has required the people to face down the government and its police. The end of slavery, human and civil rights for women and people of color, and improvement of the conditions under which most must labor, to name a few. Before any reforms have been enshrined in law or policy, reformers were beaten, imprisoned, and even killed. It required a critical mass of deliberate and disobedient citizenry to reject what was then lawful in favor of what was right, thus causing the system to bend so it would not break. It has always taken great courage. And, like soldiers, the reformers in the front lines take the most casualties. The strategy of the state is to rout them before reinforcements arrive, to silence them before they can inspire others to join the cause. Recent revelations that environmental and anti-war groups top the government's list of domestic threats have elicited responses of puzzlement from many ordinary citizens. But it's not a mistake or foolishness on the part of the state. These movements challenge the arrogance of the powerful to own the natural world and its creatures as chattel, their right to despoil the homes and habitats of others for personal gain, and the production and consumption of endless more that has led us to an impending environmental catastrophe that threatens to end life as we know it on this planet. In the past few months, federal officials have arrested dozens of environmental and animal rights activists in connection with a series of arsons and other militant actions that occurred in several western states. The charges brought against these people will bring them prison sentences of life plus hundreds of years, while those who do arson for profit normally receive 5 to 10 years in prison. Does that seem unreasonable? It's not when you understand that the heart of American law is the preservation of property interests, and that common criminals honor the idea of profit even in their crimes, but the activists have challenged the premise upon which our social order rests. We're going to hear a forum on how the law has been used to suppress social movements in the past and how it is now being used in what has been termed the Green Scare. The forum was held June 26th in New York City and arranged by the National Lawyers Guild, which is assisting in the defense of the Green Scare prisoners. The National Lawyers Guild was founded in 1937. It seeks to unite lawyers, law students, legal workers, and jailhouse lawyers in America as an effective political and social force in the service of the people, to the end that human rights shall be regarded as more sacred than property interests.
On December 7th, my friend Daniel was arrested in what would prove to be the first of the Operation Backfire raids. The Green Scare had been underway for quite some time, though. 6 members of Stop Huntington and Animal Cruelty were awaiting a trial for what was ostensibly just having a website that had the names and addresses of corporate executives whose companies did business with Huntington Animal Cruelty. Jeff Lures had served 5 years in a 22-and-a-half-year sentence for causing $40,000 worth of damage to some SUVs. And Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma had called the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, and I quote, the most serious domestic terrorist threat in the United States today. All of this was peripheral to me, though. I mean, I was and am a law student, and I wasn't friends with anyone who had been harmed by the Green Scare. It felt like it was mostly happening out west, and that there were many people out there who were dealing with it. Daniel's arrest was a real wake-up call for me. I'd just like to add my voice to the chorus of others who are saying what a caring and loving and important member of the activist community he is. I was shocked to know that he had been arrested and that he was now facing life in prison. As a law student, I read the indictment, and it didn't make any sense to me. The charges were multiplicitous. Why was Daniel being charged with 16 counts for a single arson? Of course, the answer to that would become clear in the months ahead. The severe oversentencing has led many of those indicted to turn state's evidence, and many are now implicating those around them in an attempt to save themselves. And all of this seemed like a guild project. The National Lawyers Guild is almost 70 years old, and it has been fighting government repression since 1937. Guild lawyers have been heavily involved in all of these cases. And when Dave and I approached Heidi about setting up this symposium and the hotline, she responded with unbridled enthusiasm and amazing organizational ability. I hope that the hotline, which is 1-888-NLG-ECOLAW, will help what may be the next set of indictments in the Green Scare. But we'll need your help. We'll need volunteer activists to staff it, and we'll need lawyers to offer to drive to jailhouses in the middle of the night to help those who've been arrested. I hope that we can all agree, though, that nothing is more urgent for us as progressive lawyers and future lawyers than to ensure that activists remain free, outside of prison, and apart from preparing for lengthy and burdensome lawsuits. I want to thank all of our panelists, Danny Myers, Andrew Erba, Lauren Reagan, and Brendan Story for coming, and the New York City and the national chapters for all of their help, all of the activists that are here and out doing activism somewhere else, and all of you for coming. So without further ado, I'm going to give you Danny Myers. Danny Myers has been practicing law since 1967, and he is on the executive committee of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He's also a cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's represented everyone from Marilyn Buck to Jan LeMann of the Ohio Seven to Pablo Yoruba Guzman, who's Minister of Information of the Young Lords Party. For 26 years, he worked as a member of the Attica Brothers legal team, eventually securing the brothers an $8 million settlement for the torture that they endured in prison. He is one of the most caring and inspiring members of the progressive legal community, and he's always ready to help young lawyers and young would-be lawyers. Danny will be providing us with the historical context of the Green Scare, and I think comparing it to other areas of state repression. Please join me in welcoming him.
It's wonderful to hear Grania speak so wonderfully about me, and I have to thank Grania and David and Heidi, and especially the new generation, without whom I could not be standing here almost literally today. It seems that being of my age now has certain perks, which I really appreciate. It's really an honor to be able to present some of the history of the use of the government by its standard operating tools to oppress, repress, co-opt, and do whatever they have to do in order to squash people's movements and people's organizations. And this is a very prominent contemporary example that's going to be discussed by panelists who are directly involved and greatly challenged. With regard to this bio, I must say that it requires everybody to take out a pen and put a UN before successfully. Mr. Myers unsuccessfully challenged the constitutionality of the New York felony murder statute. If I was successful, there would be no felony murder prosecutions in New York State. And unfortunately, Charles Chuck Culhane and Gary McGivin were convicted of a legal impossibility and nonetheless served life sentences. And that was a great disappointment, but we try. Often we do not succeed, but we certainly try. In terms of the historic concept of what is happening now, and we are using colors, so scares in my time now being, if I'm almost practicing law for 40 years, I must be around six decades or more. This is my color chart. Yellow, red, black, brown, lavender, green, brown, and white. And I guess from the moment I was born into a progressive home of militant trade unionists who were the targets of the state because of who they were, and that followed a history of the use of sedition laws and conspiracy laws, which I'm going to address as being really the connection between all of the movements. When I was born, people of Japanese ancestry were in internment camps in the United States. The red, if you will, color is both the McCarthy period and the Cold War, of course, and the prosecution of people because of their membership in socialist and communist organizations and who were deemed to be sympathizers during that particular period of time. Red also will always mean in this country, if you will, the indigenous peoples, the Native American people. And yesterday there was a communication from Leonard Peltier. Yesterday was the 31st anniversary of the uprising and the FBI action at Wounded Knee, for which he has always contended and we believe was wrongfully convicted of the murder of two FBI agents at that time. Black, of course, represents the black liberation movement in all of its manifestations from the moment black folk were brought here. I saw Sarah Jones last night recommend Bridge and Tunnel, in which one of her characters, who's a hip-hop rap artist, says, black were imported and browns like you are being deported. So that was a connection in a hip-hop rhythm. COINTELPRO, which Brian Glick, I see, is in the audience, has written extensively about, was an FBI orchestrated attempt to destroy the black liberation movement in the United States, principally focused against the Black Panther Party and also against those who it deemed to be the emergence, to prevent the emergence in the United States of what they called the Black Messiah, which led to the deaths and assassinations of Fred Hampton in 1969, Malcolm X in 1965, and Martin Luther King in 1968. The COINTEL papers are available. We have them. They were part of a discovery package that the defense team received, or the offense team received, in a civil rights suit that was brought on behalf of Daruba bin Wahad in New York City, who is also a victim of COINTELPRO here, who was falsely imprisoned and ultimately released. And he brought civil suits, and as part of the discovery in the civil suits, we have the complete COINTELPRO file. The brown represents in large measure here in the United States the Puerto Rican liberation struggle, the Puerto Rican independence movement. I did represent for a period of time the Young Lords Party, the Central Committee, and did represent Pablo Uribe Guzman in a major federal prosecution in which he refused to become part of the U.S. military during the Vietnam War, taking the purely political position that as a Puerto Rican whose citizenship was imposed upon him, that the United States had no right to draft him. He's a Puerto Rican. And it was a major political trial, and the outcome was a conviction and a sentence at a time when most people in 1975, the trial was 73, 74, 75, receiving probation. Yoruba, Channel 2, Channel 4, Pablo, served 18 months in Atlanta. The green is tonight's topic. Brown, again, are Muslim South Asians. I just went on a website to prepare for tonight, and the question of what possibly could be going on in South Florida around this most recent arrest of black men, African-American and Haitian men at Liberty City in a what seems to be a piece of American propaganda to assure us that the government is doing everything possible to protect us. And it really seems outlandish, and probably and most likely is that whatever statements that the government is saying was in furtherance of the conspiracy was articulated by their informer, agent provocateur. It really has all of that. And that's what's consistent about all of what is happening now. Movements and groups are demonized. Movements and people are co-opted when doing political work, people's work, mass movement work. Our groups and organizations are infiltrated when co-option and other forms of intimidation or psychological propaganda, divisions, playing on people's fears, suspicions about each other fail. There also are assassinations, as I previously referenced. And what is in the hands of the government that's been their tool, their major tool, once they ultimately criminalize groups and members of groups? What do they have? They have 18 United States Code, Section 371, and some of its spinoffs, which is the conspiracy law. It is a law that is the most easily brought and the most easily proved. It creates within it the circumstances of people becoming internally frightened by the way that law operates, and that invariably, but often not in political cases, there are people who flip. So you start with a situation in which invariably there's going to be one or more informers, there is going to be surveillance, there's going to be wiretaps, legal and illegal. There's going to be the whole range of collection of information and evidence under what is an agreement to do something wrong. And under U.S. conspiracy law, and not many countries have a conspiracy law, and not many states have a conspiracy law, and states that do have a conspiracy law, it's considered to be a lesser included offense, a lesser offense. Under U.S. law, a conspiracy, an agreement to do something wrong, is often time punished more severely than doing the actual harm. The congressional findings and rationale for that approach is that these secret agreements to do something wrong are so inherently evil and contrary to whatever we stand for that it has to be punished at least as severely That's the law, at least as severely, and in certain circumstances, more severely. And so they have brought, I am sure, in the cases that are going to be discussed tonight, the first count, and sometimes the only count, which is conspiracy. They don't want to charge the wrongdoing, because to charge the wrongdoing is much more difficult to prove than to prove an agreement. Under the law of conspiracy, once some evidence of the existence of the conspiracy is presented, there are no exceptions to the hearsay rule. A conspiracy is a partnership in crime, and the judge will so instruct the jury at the end of the case. And like all lawyers who take a case, you begin at the end. You look at what the judge is going to instruct and try to work out how you are going to defend. And that's what the law is about. Hearsay, there is no hearsay. Acts and declarations of co-conspirators are binding on non-declarants and non-actors. It doesn't matter how long or how short you're in a conspiracy. You're a member of the conspiracy. It doesn't matter what role you play. You're a member of the conspiracy. And that is guaranteed to be count one, and in some cases, the only count. And now they are using conspiracy with what is now called domestic terrorism, and or using the old statute of seditious conspiracy. Sedition is one of the oldest statutes. It goes back to the 1790s, if you will. So that you have a situation in which the arsenal that the government will use based upon conspiracy to do what? Conspiracy to commit domestic terrorism, conspiracy to any kind of substantive interstate crime, and interstate, everything is interstate. You make an intrastate phone call, you're using the means and instrumentality of commerce, and you have this federal jurisdiction. There's federal jurisdiction for everything. And if two people agree to do something, or together, or in association, I often use clients who were first arrested spitting on the federal steps of the courthouse. If I'm walking with Dave Rankin and I spit, and it's spitting is a crime, Dave Rankin and I are going to be charged with conspiracy to spit. That's the way it is. It is guilt by association. It's purely associational. In seditious conspiracy, it's advocacy. It says so. Seditious conspiracy. If two or more persons in any state or territory in any place subject to the jurisdiction of the United States conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, it is purely and to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law. So in the resistance conspiracies case in Washington, D.C., that was what the charge was. In the Ohio 7 case, that was what the charge was. We have now also, and this is, I'll end on this, wherever I go, and hopefully it's to young audiences, on how to protect yourself when confronted by the police. This is something that's extremely important. And I put up on the blackboard two phrases. Don't speak, don't consent. When everything else fails, you will be charged with 18 United States Code Section 1001. That is statements made to federal officials, false statement made to federal officials. Now, I would say it's bad enough. You say anything false to any federal official, and by the way, the same way virtually all offenses are federal, so are almost all law enforcement offices. Certainly in New York, certainly since Rudolph Giuliani was the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, we have joint forces. It was the Joint Terrorist Task Force. We have Joint Narcotics Task Forces, fraud, this. What happens is when you think that New York City police officer is knocking on the door and is asking, is your significant other home, and you say no, you think that it doesn't matter whether you're under oath or not. That's true if that New York City police officer was merely a New York City police officer, but almost every New York City police officer these days is sworn in and made a marshal or other kind of federal official, so that these operations are joint operations in New York. FBI, other federal agencies, Secret Service, New York City Police, state troopers. The thing about the law in New York, federal law in New York, knock on the door, is so-and-so home, you say no, you've just violated, you just committed a felony if so-and-so is home, a false exculpatory statement, a statement that is false, or the false exculpatory no, implicates 18 U.S.C. 1001, and they have upped the penalty. It was bad enough. It was the traditional five-year felony. If the investigation, and I will quote, if the offense involves international or domestic terrorism, as defined in Section 2331, imprisoned not more than 8 years, so that the recent change in 1001 is that it's either a five-year felony or an eight-year felony, depending on the subject matter of the investigation and their definition of terrorism, because their definition of terrorism in 2331 includes, quote-unquote, domestic terrorism. And this is what tonight's panelists are going to be speaking of. Lastly, the draconian aspects of the punishment that people are facing and going to face when charged for crimes that implicate terrorism or sedition or anything that has to do with people's movements is the operation of a sentencing guideline provision. Recently, the Supreme Court of the United States seemingly has said that the sentencing guidelines are no longer mandatory but merely advisory. In practice, we are just about where we were pre-Booker. That was the case that the Supreme Court said, was that the guidelines are advisory. Check this guideline out, and it's going to be used, I guarantee, against Lynn Stewart, a lawyer who represented a client that clearly caused the United States government to go after her, as you know. She was tried. Jury found her guilty of various offenses, including material aid to a terrorist organization. And there is a new sentencing guideline provision that will operate as follows. It's Section 3A1.4 of the sentencing guidelines. It provides for a sentencing enhancement for any felony, quote, that involved or was intended to promote a federal crime of terrorism. And, again, don't speak, don't consent. You can face the same penalties under the terrorism section if you, quote, unquote, obstruct an investigation of a federal crime of terrorism. The same guideline applies to the substantive offense of terrorism and obstructing an investigation of a federal crime of terrorism. That falls within the scope of this guideline section. What happens? What occurs? Guideline is a grid. On the top is your criminal history. Roman numeral 1 to Roman numeral 6. 1 is the best, usually the non-first-time offender. 6 is the worst. And then you go down a grid. Guideline level 1 is the lowest to 43. This guideline, regardless of your prior criminal history, let's assume you had no criminal history, and let's assume they say you obstructed a terrorist investigation. You are put in the highest criminal history category, Roman numeral 6, and you're on a level 32. You are facing a sentence under those circumstances of 210 to 262 months. So if somebody can quickly divide that by 12, you know, we're talking about 17 to 20-something years. This is what this government is presently doing. As I said, the connection between the past and the present is essentially using the same exact laws, the same exact tools, and the questions that we as lawyers always need to do is to understand the reality of the times, the reality of the use of the law, and to counsel each other and our clients in a confidential manner. The use of emails to communicate, I think, is a real mistake. And, I see a Judy Barry person here. There's another green story. Hi. So that's it for me. I'm very glad that you're here. We're going to hear now from people who are going to be working day and night to defend their clients against these kind of draconian laws with a government fully geared up to put their clients away for many, many years.
I'm back to introduce Andrew Erba. Thank you, Danny, for all your words and your wisdom. Andrew Erba primarily practices law in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. He was a part of the team of lawyers who represented persons who were arrested at the 2000 Republican Convention in Philadelphia. He represented Clark Kissinger and other protesters who were arrested for attempting to speak on behalf or in favor of Mumia Abu-Jamal at the Liberty Bell Complex in July of 2000. He specializes mainly in plaintiff civil rights work and has represented an array of clients in false arrest, malicious prosecution, excessive force, and other civil rights violations. Today, however, he is here because he was a lead counsel in United States versus Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. On the train up from Philadelphia, I mean, I was caused to think how, when I was a law student, I used to sit where you were and have what I thought were great lawyers talk and inspire me. And I always, in the back of my mind, said, well, you know, is what they're saying really real? And I'd like to start out, before I talk about the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty case, with some reality. Because I think that it's easy for people who are in the guild and people who do political activism to think that somehow they're a special breed. And the truth is, the conspiracy things that we just talked about and the laws that we're going to talk as it applies to activists have been applied for years and continue to be applied to the African-American community, to drug dealers, or what the government sees as drug dealers, unfortunately to those that they see as organized crime, and in fact, anyone that the government wishes to prosecute. And so the point that I'd like to make is, and I'd like to tell you a little story to illustrate this point, is that there is a moment that we can draw some benefit from what we're seeing. And if that moment only allows us to understand that, at least in my opinion, and I'm just a simple criminal defense attorney from Philadelphia, and I don't speak for anyone other than myself, but if it allows us to realize that in our middle class, we have not understood exactly what the government's been doing to the African-American community, then there's going to be some benefit, because what I do for the most of my practice is represent individuals who the government thinks are drug dealers. And 99% of those people, you know, are arrested with guns. 99% of those people have long histories. And I'd say 99.9% of those people are African-American males. And 100% of those African-American males that are convicted do 20, 30, 40 years in the federal court system. And I think that for years, you know, we as, you know, middle-class people, and I say middle-class, having the benefits of education and college, and we sit in rooms like this, we haven't really realized the impact on it. And we hear stories in the papers of, you know, the great burgeoning population. But the truth is, the federal government has been very serious about using conspiracy laws for years, and they have done a very effective job. And let me illustrate to you some of the points that we just talked about. You know, we all think conspiracy is something, you know, for a movie, and we don't understand exactly how it plays out. Let me ask two questions in the audience. Are there people who are practicing lawyers here? Has there anybody who's ever tried a criminal case? Why don't you raise your hand? Anybody ever picked a jury? Anybody ever argued reasonable doubt to 12 people who you don't know anything about? Anybody who ever explained to a jury that there's reasonable doubt that there's a conspiracy? Well, these concepts are so absolutely foreign to jurors that, and I tried hundreds of these cases, I can't conceive anybody understands them. I mean, the truth is, what jurors understand is the passion, or I should say, the passion play the government puts on. But let me just give you a story which explains conspiracy, and then we're going to talk about the Shack case. I represent a young gentleman, and I'll call him Jose. Jose had the misfortune or fortune to live in a place called Chester, Pennsylvania. Now, Chester, Pennsylvania is a two-street town between a very rich county called Delaware County and a richer county called Wilmington, Delaware. Now, what you do in Chester are three things. You're talking your cell phone to your homies, you drink on the corner, and you sell drugs because there's nothing else. And they sell drugs to the white people who come in from Delaware County. In any event, I was appointed to represent Jose, and Jose had the misfortune of owning a cell phone. And Jose also had the misfortune of one day calling up his cousin, who the federal government thinks is a major drug dealer, and had a conversation, and I'll paraphrase. This was the conversation. Jose, the big drug dealer, "Yo, come to my crib." Okay. 10 minutes later, telephone call. "Yo, I need some of that stuff." 20 minutes later, another telephone call. "Yo, I'm at the crib." Okay, those are the three phone calls. Now, Jose didn't realize that his cousin, the big alleged drug dealer, had a Title III warrant on him and his phone was being tapped. Jose didn't realize that that conversation was being recorded. And Jose didn't realize that he was going to be indicted as a drug dealer, because all the federal government needs to prove for a conspiracy is, as was said, a potential agreement. An agreement reaches minds. A telephone conversation they consider as part of an agreement. And in the wisdom of the federal government, because they all have the cleverness that we don't as normal people have, they have the expertise to be able to get on the stand, put their hand under oath, and look a jury in the eye and say, "Yo, come to my crib." Drug talk. "Yo, I need some shit." Drug talk. "Yo, I'm going to be there." Drug dealing. And that is the kind of evidence that the government would put in against Jose to show a conspiracy with his cousin, which will put him in very serious trouble. And Jose's trouble comes from the fact that the government is alleging this major drug operation with hundreds of thousands of kilos of cocaine being sold. And as a conspirator, even in the smallest part where he had that one conversation, Jose is responsible for every dollar that they say was sold, for every kilo that was sold, for everything that goes down on anybody in that. That weight will fall on Jose. He's just a small part of it. Now, what does this story mean to us? Well, it seems unfair, but the truth of the matter is, that's how the federal government makes cases. And let me also illustrate this story by an example of what's happening. In an indictment, there's 10 defendants, usually. Maybe there's 20 defendants. Now, as was explained to you, the federal laws are so draconian. The penalties are so harsh. And let's be honest, the people they arrest all have criminal records, which bump up their exposure, that everybody who's at the top tries to cut a deal. And the way you cut a deal is to give up somebody, and they give up the person underneath them. And so the way it works in a pyramid that the federal government does is indict 20 people. Okay, number one talks on number two. Number two talks on number three. That goes on the line. Now, my guy, Jose, is at the bottom. Turn around. He's got nobody to turn in. Nobody. We were in court the other day on motions, which was, you know, a sobering experience because, you know, I filed the motions and all the other defendants, you know, joined in. And we're looking there, and there's no other lawyers. And there's no other defendant. And Jose's going, "Boy, they almost be late." I said, "No, Jose, they're all pleading guilty and they're all going to testify against you. And that's the name of the game." So the point being that a conspiracy from the federal perspective is an opportunity for them to get any number of people to turn on anybody else. And the way they make these cases are traditionally in two ways. As stated, they have informers. Now, the informers are usually people that they arrest on charges, and those people have to give up information because they're facing penalties too. And then they have what are traditionally known as wiretaps, and they have right now internet taps. Now, the point being, I guess, of this long story is that, you know, these things aren't new. And I think that the fact that we're here today saying they're applying to activists or applying to people in the environmental movement or the animal rights movement only shows how little everybody who does political activity understands what goes on. Because I'm telling you, this isn't new for the federal government. It isn't new for the FBI. They've been doing this for years, and they're very good at it. And the truth of the matter is, I represented hundreds of activists that always tell me, boy, I'm going to go to the wall. Let them arrest me. And I look them in the eye, and I say, look, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I have to tell you bitter news. The last place you want to be is a defendant. And the last place you want to be is a defendant in federal court. Now, let me tell you the reason why. And I'll lead up to what we're here to talk about today. That is United States versus Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, which is a case that we tried in the District of New Jersey in Trenton. Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty is part of a large genre of activists called animal rights activists. And it's sort of a group which is focused on trying to stop animal experimentation at a lab in New Jersey in England called Huntington Life Science. Now, in England, for years, they've had protests against Huntington Life Science, and Huntington Life Science became afraid of the English protesters, and they came to the United States in 2001 and incorporated here. Now, I have to give you a little background on the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty movement because, you know, I give them credit where credit is due. I mean, these are clever and hardworking activists. What the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty movement decided was mere protests don't get us very far. So what they decided to be, and very cleverly, they said, let's go to the financial underpinnings of a company such as Huntington Life Science. So what they did in England was had a campaign of contacting shareholders and trying to get the shareholders of this corporation to divest. Then they go and contact the employees of suppliers of the various companies under the theory that the employees would then go to their suppliers and say, we don't want to do business with Huntington Life Science, and Huntington Life Science wouldn't have, you know, the ability to go forward. And we're talking about all kinds of people, the security company, the company that sold them toilet paper. I mean, these people, all the activists, I give them credit. I mean, they put their actions where their words were. Now, in 2001, as they say, Huntington Life Science came to Millstone, New Jersey, and opened a laboratory. Well, protests started in the United States, and it was protests by individuals very savvy on the Internet. And let me ask, who has a blog here? You can raise your hand. No one's going to know. And who uses email? Everybody, right? And who communicates with all your friends in email? Everybody. Well, what the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty campaign decided to do was they would use the Internet to do something to organize for various activities. And they put up a series of websites, all involved various protests. And I have to admit, from the government's perspective, some of the websites were probably over the edge. I mean, from the people in this room, I'm sure you would go, I mean, you would say, well, so what? I mean, let me give you an example, which the government was very perturbed about. They would have websites which would have, you know, large, you know, pages which would describe something called direct action. I kid you not. I mean, believe me. It said direct action. And they said what direct action was, and we as this movement believe in direct action and what have you. Now, government was very offended at that. There was another example that the government was offended at, and these are all, I'm not making this up, this is true stuff. In England, before the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty campaign came to America, they had a various number of various right-wing groups which would, you know, sort of scientific advisors. Well, in any event, they put up a list of top 20 terror tactics which were used by the animal rights community, and they published it in the newspaper. And this was a right-wing think tank. And it had such terrible tactics as, you know, late-night phone calls. I don't know, went down a list, 20 things, pretty silly things. In any event, the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty people thought that was funny. And so on their webpage, they put up the top 20 terror tactics, and they said, now this is what they're saying we do. Isn't this stupid? Don't do this. This is what they do. But at the bottom, it says, please be careful, folks. So in any event, these are the things that were posted on their website, and this was a minor example of, you know, some of the things. I mean, because other things became, I think, fairly, you know, at the edge or over the edge. In any event, what this became was the epicenter for the animal rights movement in the United States in the Stop Hunting and Animal Rights community. And a lot of the younger activists would go to the webpage and find out about demonstrations and go to demonstrations. Now, the other component of the webpage was something which the animal rights movement has been using for years, which is sort of a newsletter section, you know, sort of pumps them up. You know, people would send anonymous emails. You know, we went to somebody's house in North Dakota and we did this home demonstration. Because I have to say that the animal rights movement, or at least the people I represented, what they did was they took their voice to the street. And I mean the street. I mean, if you were a person who worked for Hunting and Life Science or an entity which did business with Hunting and Life Science, they would be in your street. They don't care. If you were in Rapawan, New Jersey, they'd be in your street. If you were on, you know, Fifth Avenue, where Andrew Baker, who was the president of HLS, was, they'd be there. I mean, they were there with their bullhorns, they were there with their chants, they were there with their place cards, they were marching. Well, needless to say, they stepped on a lot of toes. And ultimately, and I think we've heard a little bit about it, and we might hear a little bit more, I mean, Congress became very disturbed about the animal rights movement. And, you know, there's been movement afoot to put together, you know, a number of laws to stop this kind of protest. Well, in any event, the laws on the books, at least in my opinion, were pretty neutral and pretty vague. Now, that did not stop the U.S. Attorney from indicting seven people and plus a corporation called Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, because in order to become 503 exempt, when the campaign came to America, they decided to incorporate, and they incorporated in Delaware. So you had seven individuals plus a corporation, which the U.S. Attorney indicted. Now, the indictment was a masterpiece, in my opinion, and obviously it's only my opinion, and to the extent that other people would feel differently, including the FBI, I'm sure that they would take that position. But it was a masterpiece of innuendo, because what the indictment did, and let me just step back to what, you know, was just told you. If you read the indictment, you would see that the federal government was basically saying that these seven individuals, including three who lived in New Jersey, you know, masterminded this entire set of events and were controlled all these activists in the world through their websites. Now, let's be honest. I mean, those of you who've been in the activist community for years, one thing that's pretty obvious in the activist community is there's no generals. I mean, if you're telling me, I mean, if you could get a demonstration where you could get five people to agree who's leading it, you know, you're better off than me. In any event, I mean, that's the context of this matter, and that's the truth of the matter, and that's what everybody in this room is laughing at. But it goes back to what I said before. When you present this case in front of a jury who is from a middle-class environment, and they've been, you know, inundated since September 11th with the frightening effects of the terrorism, you know, you really have a hard road to haul. Now, let me also step back and let you explain, because I don't know if it's really the purpose here, but I'll give you my own insights for those of you who haven't tried criminal cases. I mean, how do you get to a criminal case? I mean, you know, criminal defense attorneys do this all the time, and so we're sort of numb to it. I mean, basically, let me tell you, and I'll give you an example in this case. First of all, U.S. government did one amazing thing. They decided, just before trial, file a motion, tell the judge, Your Honor, this jury has to be anonymous. Everybody's going, why? Because the activists might get the jurors' names and go and harass them. And we're going, what is going on here? So in any event, of course, the judge, being a conservative individual in her own right, said, well, that seems good to me. And so we ended up with an anonymous jury. So we're faced with the fact of picking a jury pool where, in New Jersey, you don't even get to ask questions of the jury. The judge asks the questions, and you sort of check them out. It would be like you people were the jury. The judge was over here saying, all people who couldn't be fair, please raise their hand. Nobody fair. Counsel also didn't be fair. So, you know, you ended up with knowing very little about a veneer panel that you didn't have to pick, and you picked the best of a bad lot that you don't know. In any event, you end up with 12 people who, you know, unfortunately, in our case, you know, probably knew very little about animal rights, because the government also did another motion which cut the heart out of the case. They said, Judge, this case is not about animal rights. It's not about the efficacy of whether animals should be used in experimentation. It's about a conspiracy. And the judge said, well, you know, I gotta say that's right. And so what that meant was the only thing we were allowed to argue was the constitutional issues. The clients weren't allowed to put on evidence that what they believed really had some sense to it, that they were living and breathing activists. And that's an important issue, because what you have to understand is when you're trying a case, you know, look, cases are not, I mean, who's in law school here? Raise your hand. You can admit. Okay, you read cases in books, right? Boy, those cases look nice, beginning, end, holding, works out. Well, that is a case book, and that is what law school is about. You know, in the real world, all of this doesn't mean much of anything. It's a tug of war on a trial. And if you can't present from the activist side what's going on in people's minds and why are they activists and what motivates them, you know, you're not going to get very far with a jury that already thinks the activists are kind of, you know, off the wall. Because I tell you, most jurors, even the jurors that we put in our pool who maybe marched against the war in Vietnam, stopped marching a long time ago. And they're not marching today. And they're looking at these individuals that, why are they doing this? So in any event, government killed us in two ways. One, the anonymous jury, which made the jurors think that this was, the worst case in the world. Two, you know, said that we couldn't argue issues which went to the efficacy of science. So in any event, what we left were was what the government wanted us to argue, which unfortunately, I have to tell you, is a tough thing. Now, for those of you who are not in law school, let me give you a little overview. For those of you in law school, hopefully you've all had constitutional law, so what I'm saying would make some sense. The government did two theories. And I said, you know, don't forget, the background, all the government is proving is that the Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty defendants operated a website and operated email. The government never suggested that any of those individual defendants did any individual act which caused any damage to any party. The government tried their case on two theories. One is the incitement doctrine, and the other is the true threats doctrine. Now, for those who have been to constitutional law, you recognize the case called Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire? See what kind of sharpness here. Anybody take a bar of you? No. Okay. Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire is an old, old case, you know, out of New Hampshire. And it really encapsulates what's called the fighting words doctrine. And in Chaplinsky, you know, some cop told some other guy to move along. The guy told the cop, you're a dirty cop, and the cop arrests him. And it goes up to the Supreme Court, and the issue was, is that the kind of language which would provoke the police to arrest the individual? And the Supreme Court, as they usually do, cut the baby in half and established in this 1930s or 1920s case that, you know, you have to have some pretty real fighting words in order for pure words to create action to hold somebody responsible. Well, this doctrine lay dormant for maybe 20, 30 years until, you know, the unfortunate 50s or the late 40s when the Smith Acts came up. And people are aware of the Smith Acts. Those are the acts which made it against the law to be a member of the Communist Party, really, you know, to think anything different from the United States government. Well, the quintessential incitement case was Brandenburg versus Ohio. And in Ohio, Brandenburg was a socialist, I believe, and he gave some big speech and, you know, they went out and they did some burning, they did something else. State of Ohio, being a great and wonderful state, prosecuted Mr. Brandenburg and eventually got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court was faced with that pure issue. When does speech cross the line so as to hold somebody responsible? Now, this was a decision in the late 50s when the Supreme Court really came to grips with some of these things. And a test in the Supreme Court was quite logical. What the Supreme Court said was, well, just words aren't enough to incite. You have to have some specific action. And there has to be an immediacy to that action. And that makes sense, too, because, look, we're all here talking, and you're listening to me, and I'm sure I'm firing you up incredibly. And if you go out and do something, you know, this weekend, and they come back and hold me responsible, I'm going to say, listen, you know, they had time to cool. They had time to think. They're their own people. On the other side, if you all leave this room, go out and do whatever you're going to do, then I think you could argue some incitement because there is that level of immediacy. Well, in any event, the next immediacy case which came out of the Vietnam War area was the Watts case. And in Watts, you know, you had your typical anti-war protest, which you couldn't have today. Washington Mall, some guy says, you know, he's burning his draft card. I guess he was trying to impress his girlfriend in any event. He says, you know, if I had a gun, I'd get that LBJ. Whoa, you know? So they indicted him immediately. Well, the Supreme Court pulled that out and said, look, come on. You can't believe that Mr. Watts really was going to get LBJ. You can't believe that his states really incited anybody. Then we have the third leg of the trilogy, and I'll get to how it applies. It's Claiborne versus NAACP, which is a civil case coming out of Mississippi. And in Claiborne versus Mississippi, the NAACP had a large organizing campaign in Claiborne, Mississippi, to stop blacks from patronizing whites. And it was a pretty tough campaign. I mean, they had some pretty vicious speakers. They had people who said, look, you know, we'd follow you to church, and they spoke at churches, don't patronize the white merchants. In any event, one of the NAACP representatives gave a very rhetorical and hot speech, which said, you know, I'm tired of you people and people in this community, you know, patronizing whites. We're going to break their legs. Well, down the road, windows got broken, some legs got broken, and the state of Mississippi sued the NAACP and eventually got up to the Supreme Court. And again, the Supreme Court applied the Brandenburg Doctrine to say, look, you can't hold an organization responsible unless there is a level of immediacy on the language which would allow us to go that route. Now, that lay dormant for a number of years until, unfortunately, and it goes to show you that you know, we all live in a world where everybody, you know, either helps or hurts anybody else. You know, there was a case out of the Ninth Circuit in California which involved the anti-abortion protesters. Well, this was during the time when they decided to be aggressively, you know, shooting and killing doctors, and they put up a website which, you know, and I'm not making this up. I mean, it goes to show you some people have, you know, absolutely no taste. They put up a website of doctors' pictures, wanted, and as each doctor was killed, they put an X through it and gray it out, and they have flashing lights, next one. Any event, they were sued, and the Ninth Circuit said, I'm sorry, that is incitement. So that's the level of the law that the government used against the Shaq individuals. And what they said was, you know, your website was up there. Because the web is such a large interconnected network, and because it's really its own echo chamber, by putting up things like the top 20 terror tactics, by putting up things on the webpage which describes direct action, by putting up the various, you know, reports I told you that they put in, which, you know, people trumpeted their various, you know, home demonstrations, that incited other people to take actions. Now, in this room, I'm sure you're thinking, boy, is that absurd. Well, it wasn't absurd to the jury. They had no problem saying, wow, that website that the government never, and let me also lay this foundation, the government never proved that anybody ever went to that website. They produced not one person who stood up on the court and said, listen, I went there. Boy, that got me so hot. I went out and did those actions. To the contrary, the government produced one person who, you know, I had the pleasure of cross-examining. He was a kid from Ohio. Again, example of somebody who came in, got caught in the web, got turned. Anyway, he was a real nice kid. He said, you know, I love animals. I love animal rights. And I went to the website, and it was very informative. And then we asked him, well, did the stuff on the website incite you to do anything? Oh, no. I thought about it. I just got information. I thought it was great. You know, he was our number one witness. Didn't make a difference to the jury, right? Didn't care. And they went down on that count. And that count is important because I gave Heidi some material and hopefully she'll make it available. Because if you read the act itself, which is the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, you couldn't conceive, if you read that act, that anybody would possibly be penalized for just speaking on advocacy. The act itself, on its face, talks about individuals who conspire or cross state lines to interfere in an animal enterprise and damage it, which makes sense. That is, if you're going to New Jersey from New York to break in and free some animals, okay, you could be prosecuted under that. It would be a trespass action. But can you possibly logically say that this act, which doesn't necessarily preclude any individual from organizing the internet, means that? I submit it doesn't. Of course, the government submitted otherwise, and they won. Now, that probably is more logical than the next part of the case that I'm going to talk about.